This edition of Farm in the Countryside is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farm in the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. Hedging crops like corn and beans is common practice, but do livestock producers take advantage of the opportunities hedging cattle? We discuss the pros and cons of what one long-term study says are the key takeaways to consider in achieving more consistent returns in the cattle industry. It's our topic for this week's Farming the Countryside, brought to you by Pivot BioProven. In 2020, I had the chance to use a new corn nitrogen product firsthand in my fields, Pivot BioProven. Pivot BioProven adheres to the root of the corn plant, creating a mutually beneficial nitrogen-generating partnership that stays strong all the way through harvest. It's the weather-resistant and sustainable way to achieve more predictable, more productive yields than ever before. After a successful trial run in 2020, I hope you'll follow me on an expanded use of Pivot BioProven in the 2021 growing season. If you're like me and want to make sure your corn has the nitrogen it needs, weather or not, then check out Pivot BioProven. It'll change the way you think about nitrogen. You can learn more at pivotbio.com. As many of you know, we've been raising cattle on our farm since before I was born. We're mostly a stocker operation, but we have retained ownership on cattle in the feedlot at times. I must confess that I use futures and options contracts for grains, but not as often when it comes to cattle. That's why some recent research from Brian Coffey at Kansas State caught my eye. He conducted a long-term look at hedging strategies for cattle. The takeaways are ones that have me rethinking some of what we do. Of course, every operation is different. There are many factors such as the segment of the industry you're in, the risk you can stand, and your profit goals. Even if you don't happen to even have cattle, I think the discussion is one with broader applications to other commodities. Brian Coffey is my guest. Brian is the Associate Professor of Ag Economics at K-State University. We're going to talk a little bit about livestock, specifically cattle and some marketing, and we'll probably cover all parts of the marketing scheme here from cow-calf all the way up to fed cattle. Brian, I appreciate the chance to visit with you, and perhaps I should open up with you just telling folks a little bit about the research that you do there at K-State. I know that you deal with production, you deal with futures and options trading, and I even read where you have a background working in Central Asia, of all things, as well. So you've got quite a background.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, glad to be here today. And I do have a little bit of a variety of things that I work on here at K-State. I teach some of their undergraduate classes. That's the bulk of my time. So I teach a production economics class, and then I teach a futures and options trading class. And then trying to connect my research with some of the teaching interests, I do some scholarship of teaching and learning research where we think about how students learn, outcomes of different teaching methods and those kind of things. And then a bigger part of my research I would describe, like you said, sort of broadly as livestock risk management. And some of that is looking at futures and options and how producers can use those to manage price risk. And so that takes up a lot of the work that I do here.
I'm going to start by focusing on some research you did on hedging, specifically with live cattle, but I will tell the audience here, we're going to talk about different segments of the cattle industry, because I know we have a lot of cow-calf producers that listen, as well as, stocker feeder folks and all different segments of the industry. But correct me if I'm wrong on this, because we are cattle producers, we're ranchers here in Northwest Missouri. I think on the crop side, people think about hedging, corn and soybeans, wheat, all of the time. But it seems to me that with cattle, you don't hear about it as much. That is at least my perception. I don't know what you see out there, but do you think that a lot of folks do not hedge their cattle because they believe that they are at least giving up some potential profits, or that they can't hedge in the profits they want? What is your experience in the research and talking with a lot of ranchers out there at K-State?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that both on the crop and livestock side, one of the things that we've seen over the years is that producers don't hedge as much as we academic types would think that they would. And that's kind of been a persistent finding. I think one of the things, some of the research that we looked at here a couple years ago using a Farm Credit Services survey, it does look like that grain farmers, grain producers' use of forward pricing methods is increasing over the years. As far as comparing that to livestock specific, I'm not sure. I think anecdotally what you said is what you would hear, that livestock producers are probably less likely to use the futures and options for hedging. I'm not sure exactly why. I think sometimes we get into a situation where people go out and they hedge their sale, let's say sale of livestock, maybe once or twice, and they don't get an outcome that they were expecting, and maybe they didn't have realistic goals going in, and you sort of get a bad taste in your mouth from the one-off try at it, and then you drop out, you know, and then you might come back and try to hedge again when prices are moving against you. And really, for hedging to work, the sort of textbook hedging is pure risk management. And like you said, you do give up some upside potential, but you also knock off the potential of big losses. And so I think, you know, the having the longer term hedging program where you're doing it over and over again, I think people are more likely to see the benefits. So I think, I think that's probably part of the issue is people come in and hedge maybe one time, don't have a real good experience, and then move on.
Your research, I believe, looked at a 10-year period, 2010 up to 2020, and you were specifically looking, I believe, at fed cattle. So folks that were taking stockers, I'm not sure what weight they might have been, put them in the feedlot. But over that 10-year period, your research would say hedging consistently every time is the way to go, that method returned more than not hedging. Is that right?
Well, I think, you know, we do report, or I do report in that study, some average prices. But I think that the big point of hedging is that the benefit isn't that you're trying to increase your returns. And I think that's where we need to do a better job of explaining this to producers. So the benefit of hedging is that you get a more predictable return and that you avoid losses that could be catastrophic to your operation, you know, a bad year that basically just ends things for you, you can't recover from. And so we wouldn't expect that over time hedging would actually increase your returns, right? So what hedging does is it gives you a way to offset your physical position in cattle, cash cattle, in the futures market. And then those two investments move in opposite directions. So if prices are going up, then your cash cattle, those assets are gaining in value, but your investment in the futures market will be losing in value. And then the opposite's also true. If the market's moving against you in the cash side, then your futures market investment is gaining value. And so what happens is, as those two things are offsetting, if it's bad times in the cash market, then you avoid those losses because you have gains in the futures market. And that's the goal of hedging, is to having that more predictable return and avoiding the extremes. Now, what that means is, of course, that sometimes you would avoid some good extremes, right? If prices in the cash market are moving in your favor, but you're hedged, you're going to give up some of those potential gains, but the return for that is when you put your cattle on feed and you're planning forward, you have a much greater ability to predict what you're going to sell those animals for and what your revenue is going to be.
I don't know if your research covered this or not, but do you find that the willingness for us to hedge is a lot based on how much risk we're willing to take? So
perhaps if I'm highly leveraged, that's something I need to do with the hedging, whereas some others are willing to take the risk and say, well, maybe I will catch that upside, but I'm willing to take the risk, hopefully not catastrophic loss. But how does that influence either our willingness to hedge or where we are going to hedge, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right there. We just completed a grain marketing workshop here last week, and we talked about this quite a bit, about risk tolerance, you know, that some people, it could just be their attitude. You know, some of us are okay to roll the dice and know that by accepting the chance of having a greater loss, that we're also exposing ourselves to the chance to have a greater gain. And some of us just have personalities and attitudes that are able to roll with that. And so, you know, those kind of people, yeah, maybe hedging doesn't fit your risk tolerance and your risk management attitude. And then the other thing that you mentioned is really important too, you know, the financial health of your operation or the financial status of your operation, that, you know, what's the worst case scenario that you can absorb? And if you kind of know where that is, then, you know, you could use something like futures markets or options on futures to avoid losing any more than you can absorb. So, yeah, I think setting those, you know, price targets and setting your risk management strategies based on, one, what you're willing to accept, and then, two, you know, what the financial status of your operation can absorb.
You brought up something that I wanted to get to. We've been using the term hedging, but obviously there's lots of different ways you could hedge. So Do you find, and certainly there's not one right way to do this, but In your research, was it mostly going in and taking a position on the board? Was it using options, or did that vary, again, depending on how much risk a person was willing to take?
Yeah, so I didn't really compare futures and options. So the one study that I've got out there on Ag Manager basically just went back, like you mentioned, from 2010 to 2020, and we just compared what if I used futures contracts to hedge the sale of live cattle. And it's kind of an assumption. I just went in and said, okay, if I hedged every single week, you know, thinking about a 160-day feeding period, then what would the outcome be? And so that let me sort of generate a hedged price series that we could compare to the unhedged. Did look at options, and kind of I have some material out there about how livestock options work and how they let you set a, you know, if you're a seller, set a price floor, if you're a buyer, set a price ceiling. But I didn't really compare those to say which is best. And I think what you mentioned there is really a key, is it's probably hard to say, you know, this is the right way to manage risk, or this is the right way to hedge. Futures and options offer different benefits and have different costs. And it really does depend on, you know, the individual and the operation and what fits best for them.
Of course, you were looking at fed cattle, but we have a lot of folks that listen to this broadcast that would certainly be cow-calf producers. They may be stocker producers. In your time, you know, and looking at production economics and so forth, what are some of the things that we could do if we're at another portion of the supply chain to think about, well, how could I, in a sense, hedge my operation or take some of that risk out? What would be your strategies that you would give to folks in other segments of the livestock production?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of the basic ideas are the same. There is a feeder cattle contract with the CME group there, and so that one's targeted at the 7 to 9 weight animals, you know, the ones like you mentioned that are basically ready to go on feed, to go into the feedlot. And so if you're marketing animals or buying animals in that price range, then, you know, the same ideas that there are futures, there's a futures contract out there. There are options on those futures contracts that you could use. So those are out there. As you get into the lighter weight calves, you know, if you're selling the 5 to 6 weight weaned calves or something like that, a lot of people do try to use the feeder cattle contract. And at that case, in that case, it's what we call a cross hedge, and it just means that the commodity that you're hedging, you know, that 500-pound calf, doesn't exactly match the contract specifications. And so in that case, the difference between the cash and the futures price can tend to be a little less predictable. And so that takes a little bit more care. And sometimes you don't hedge at a one-to-one ratio. You might need to vary that a little bit. So the principle's still the same. It's a little bit more complex, and people have different degrees of success with that. I think also, just mentioning that the futures and options are one way to manage price risk, and there's certainly others out there, right? I mean, there are things that people do, such as the preconditioning or doing things to sort of improve, set their animals apart from everybody else's. I mean, I think that's, in a sense, a way to sort of try to be a little bit above the average in the market. So I think that helps. I mean, there's certainly forward contracts and things out there like that where you could get a forward price on the animal and it wouldn't require you to go out and, take a futures market position. So there are other ways to do it also.
I don't know if you get into this with some of your classes and your research as well, but certainly in the cattle industry, we hear a lot of talk about that, the prices on the futures don't seem to marry up sometimes with the prices we're seeing out there live. That gap is pretty large, and price discovery sometimes doesn't seem to work as well as it used to. I'm interested what you see there in Kansas, or if you have really seen these markets change fundamentally in the time that you've studied the futures markets, of, in a sense, how they work in conjunction with what we're seeing actually out there on a live basis.
Yeah, you're certainly right. That is a big topic these days, and a lot of people interested in that and concerned about it. I guess, the contract I would be a little bit more familiar with there is live cattle, but I think a lot of the same things would apply to the feeder cattle contract. I do think going through like the 2014, 2015, and up into 16 time period, I mean, that was just a time period like we hadn't seen before, with prices going up to historic levels and then dropping off so quickly. And we did see during that time period that the basis, that difference between the futures and cash price, that was much more erratic than it had been for the past several years. And, in absolute value terms, wider than it had been in previous years. So I think there was a lot of, there was some time there where prices were moving quickly and maybe, markets weren't adjusting quite as fast as usual. I do think, though, looking at over time, even during those kind of outlier years there, the basis risk is still much, much less than the price risk. So I think even though we had some, some basis levels there that we weren't familiar with, still those contracts, the futures prices and the cash prices still were moving together in a way that would allow people to offset price risk with a much, much more manageable basis risk.
Brian, of course, we came through an interesting, we'll use that word, year in 2020. The cattle market with COVID, we had plant shutdowns, we had plant fires, and all kinds of things that disrupted the market. I'm interested, how much did all of this other stuff in 2020 impact the cattle cycle going forward, or did it have that much impact? Is it going to be something in 2021 and beyond that, while there were certainly some disruptions, it didn't have a long-term impact? How do you see it?
Yeah, that is a tough one, really, to think about exactly how long it's going to take for things to get back to a normal, if you will. But I think as far as the live cattle backlog from the plant shutdowns, that was the big one, right? And we had sort of a problem there. We had cattle on feed. We were going in with a big inventory of cattle on feed there in January, February, March of last year, and then suddenly, for a lot of people, no place to get those cattle out. So then that took a long time, I think, to kind of chew through that backed up inventory. It seems like, you know, that we have accomplished that, and thankfully beef demand here and abroad has remained strong, and I think that's really helped us get through that. You know, going forward now and where we are in the cattle cycle, that's also sometimes predicting and explaining that. It seems like there's a little bit of an art to it, but it seems like, you know, that we probably could get back on, you know, something of a more normal progress here this year.
It's hard for us to know what normal is anymore, isn't it?
It really is, yeah, and with things changing, you know, and we have to remember, as big of an issue as COVID was, certainly nothing, we hadn't seen anything like that before. We have to also remember that the rest of the world doesn't just stop, right? We still had all kinds of things going on with trade agreements or trade agreements that might happen. We still had things going on with, you know, the way consumers view beef and those kind of things. So all of those things are at the same time changing and going on in the world. And so a lot of things changing at the same time. And so, like you said, it is tough to know, you know, how to define normal.
Do you think that COVID has changed the way going forward that we will consume beef, and how much, or how we might be able to trade with other countries and how they may consume it, or is it too early to know yet?
I think that it's pretty safe to say things will change. I think it's tough to say exactly how. You know, I think the supply chain is the big question on a lot of people's mind, you know, the way that we are currently set up. I think, you know, the U.S. is great at producing beef that is, you know, efficiently. I'm sorry, the U.S. is great at efficiently producing beef, and we're known for high quality beef, and that's what we're set up for. But we did see, you know, that when we had this kind of shock of an event from COVID, that there were places in the supply chain that were weak, that weren't real resilient to that. So I think we're going to have to balance, you know, the efficiency and the benefits of our current supply chain with trying to have some kind of management against those unexpected events. And I think as people sort that out going forward, you know, there'll be some innovation and some changes there. Again, exactly how that's going to work out is hard to say, but I do think we'll see some changes.
Brian, before we wind up, you mentioned some of that research. How can folks find out more or see some of that? I believe you've got it out there so people can easily find it.
Yeah, so one place to start would be agmanager.info, and that's the extension website that our Department of Agricultural Economics at Kansas State University maintains. And we've got all kinds of stuff on there from many, many different people about livestock, grains, you know, all kinds of different stuff, agribusiness stuff, macroeconomic outlook kind of things. And so I would say, you know, start there. It's got the search function. And so whatever you're interested in, you know, if it's live cattle or feeder cattle or wheat, whatever you're interested in, you can kind of narrow down there and find a lot of good material, written, video, and different kinds of things.
Very good. Good information. I appreciate the time today.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.
I want to highlight the website that Brian mentioned at the end of our interview. It's agmanager.info. There's a lot of good information on that website dealing with many facets of the ag industry. It goes way beyond what we discussed here today, although you can find that research of Brian's along with much more. And be sure to connect with us with your story and topic ideas. The easiest way to get in touch is by following the program on Facebook. Just look for Farming the Countryside there. We highlight each week's program plus other info you can use. And you can always follow our daily feature, American Countryside, on Facebook, or just go to AmericanCountryside.com or your local radio station. As always, thanks for listening. I'll catch you next time on Farming the Countryside. Farming the Countryside has been brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.